This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and in studio for this opportunity to find out what's happening in Northwest Indiana. And I guess we're talking first about politics, aren't we, Ruth Needleman?
Well, I thought a different approach was called for.
Well, that's
because now's the time to get your questions together.
Yeah.
Because every candidate offers transparency, accountability, a voice for the people. But the question is, what are you going to do? And what have you done? Because a lot of times we hear the speeches and it doesn't give us a basis for making up our minds. So I have some questions for you. Fundamentally, what is your approach to economic development? Everybody says they're going to get investments and business here, but will your economic development benefit the people who already live here? Will there be, when you develop any area, some low-cost and mixed housing? This is very important because with the influx of Chicagoans, housing prices in a place like Gary, but also in the suburbs, are beginning to climb out of the reach of people who are already here. And in order for a community to benefit from development, there needs to be something called a community benefits agreement. We tried to get one at the airport. We tried to get one when IUN built its big building. Mm-hmm. And they resist it because they make a promise to look at local hiring. And then, for example, when IUN built its expansion building for millions of dollars, there was no one from Gary working there. And so we want a community benefits agreement that calls for local hiring. How about investment in people? Let's have training and mixed housing part of every economic development. Now, we have in the city of Gary this partnership called MIACO. Mm-hmm. It's kind of disappeared from the news for a while. But basically, a company set up by Richard Daley in Chicago and staffed by his crew of investors, they're all tied to Daley, have say-so over 40% of Gary's landmass development. Well, I want to know the position of city council people, of mayors. What is your attitude towards MIACO? Are we going to continue to be a colony of Chicago serving their needs, or are we going to serve our needs? Then, of course, we have our Gary-Chicago Airport. Now, it's an important cog in a very horrible, illegal and cruel system of immigration that has been perpetrated by the federal government. Will you, as a candidate, oppose our city's complicity in Trump's inhuman immigration practices? We have weekly deportation flights. We just learned that people are not fed from 6 in the morning when they leave Kankakee until they arrive in a shelter in Mexico. We need to get information on these flights. Now, Representative Iskloski is trying. Our prior city councilwoman, Reagan Hatcher, tried, and they don't give us any information. And I just want to point out, because there was a very interesting article in today's paper that gave us the five myths at the border. And I'm just going to say them quickly, mm-hmm. because this should be part of our questions. Trump says he could shut down the border. It would be, in fact, impossible to do that. Two, building the wall will prevent drug trafficking. Of course, the fact is most of the drugs come in through legal ports of entry. He says more immigrants are entering illegally. The number of illegal crossings is down and has been down. And by the way, refugees and asylum seekers are not illegal. Most illegal immigration comes over this border. No, it comes in at our airports, and it's people who overstay their visa. And then finally, by securing his border wall, he's making us safer. There has not been one new linear mile of border wall completed under Trump. So he's talk, and we need to pin our people down to find out if we are helping to advance this cruel policies. And this is at the top of my list, even though it wasn't at the top of my list.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, what will you do to bring back our public schools? Are you going to continue to support a voucher system that bleeds our public school system dry? Then, getting towards the end, environmental justice. What will you do to clean up not just Gary, East Chicago, Hammond, Whiting, the whole area? Our groundwater is contaminated. Our soil is contaminated. People are still drinking out of lead pipes because they want homeowners to lay out $3,000 to $5,000 to replace their own pipes. And then lastly, in the presidential election, people are talking about reparations. Now, a city like Gary, what is the policy? Are you going to support reparations? What are you suggesting towards that end? Anyhow, those are just a few questions. Then I have a few announcements, if I may.
Okay.
The first one is we are coming up on our next Can We Talk? Now, Can We Talk is a community-based, absolutely free trauma healing program that meets once a month. We provide a free dinner, and we share some stories. And it is amazing how sharing your story, listening to other people's stories, has a very healing effect. So our next one is on April 22nd. That's a Monday evening at 6 o'clock. We will provide free dinner and then share our stories with free childcare also provided. It will take place at Trinity United Church of Christ on 20th Avenue and Lincoln. Then also there is coming up a prayer for the planet. On April 27th, which is a Saturday at 2 p.m., there will be a vigil, an interfaith vigil to pray for the health of our planet at the Gary Bathing Beach Auditorium at 2 p.m. And then finally, Easter's coming up. And our Brothers Keepers, as usual, are doing wonderful things for people who are homeless and mealless. And they will be hosting the 33rd anniversary Easter meal. And they need help. They need you to donate money. They need you to donate food and even to donate time. And so April 21st, 2019, Tawana Jennings and Jelena Jeffries invite you to join them and pay it forward. And Brothers Keepers is at 2120 Broadway in Gary, and they will be feeding the homeless. If you're able to donate money or a dish, you can contact Tawana at 386-675-5238, and we hope that you will do so. And then my last thing is a city council candidates debate coming up.
Mm-hmm.
This will be, I'm glad I didn't write down the date. This will be Sunday. I'm looking it up as we speak. It is this Sunday, the 14th, at Temple Israel in the Miller section of Gary on Montgomery and Grand. And at 3 o'clock, they will host a candidates debate for those people running for at-large city council seats. And then at 5:30, the candidates for the district positions. Early voting is now open. You might want to attend a debate or two first, but you don't want to miss your chance to vote early because they have collapsed our precincts and you are no longer probably voting where you used to vote. I got a postcard in the mail telling me to go someplace else.
I was going to ask you because Gary was one of the two
most
affected by the
right.
Redistricting, the consolidation of districts, not redistricting the consolidation
right.
of districts here in Lake County. And
I don't know if everybody got a postcard, but it doesn't say, and you can get there through public transportation. It doesn't have directions to get at the new polling place. And I, of course, will vote early at the Genesis Center. And I recommend early voting for everyone because there'll be a lot of confusion because of the disappearance of so many precincts.
I think even as of yesterday, actually, there was a kind of surprise to some that work in the voter registration and election board office, the fact that they noticed that on the very first day of early voting, which was on Tuesday, that there were more people who showed up during that first day of voting in East Chicago than in Gary. They were kind of hoping and supposing that Gary would be the one with the most number of early voters for the first day, but that can always change. It may be changing even today.
And we need it to change. People are confused, and our public transportation system does not support this redesigning of precincts, because there might be a bus that can get you from A to Z, but it could take you half a day. And so vote early. Don't vote often.
Well, you know, that's not allowed by Indiana election law, to be sure. But
that's right.
The point is to be sure to vote if you're registered to do so.
And get your questions together, because it's not enough to listen to what candidates say. They all sound the same.
I was going to ask in regards to that, since we have so many mayoral candidates on the ballot, aside from the incumbent, that we have. At least nobody yet has really mentioned much as to if there are any common questions or any unique questions, I guess, that can be posed to them. You brought up some common questions.
Well, I think the Miyako question for the Gary mayors is very important, because I'm going to have somebody actually on my radio show this Thursday on WLTH, I'll say it quietly, at 6 o'clock, who just wrote a graduate paper on Miyako. And so he's not saying it's good, it's bad, but he does call it neocolonialism. Because
interesting way to approach it, yes.
Miyako is completely controlled out of Mayor Daley's office. Almost everybody comes from this organization called Resolute, which I had never heard of. And so this will be very interesting, because he has some facts I wasn't able to dig up. And whether or not this is going to move forward or not is critical to the future of Gary, because they have dibs on the most desirable plots of land. They have a dib on the Broadway corridor. Why would we give the Broadway corridor to somebody in Chicago to decide what to do? Now, what they're going to do is clear the titles. But then when the land gets sold, 65% of the profit goes to Miyako. The city gets 35%. That is not just exploitation. That's expropriation, and I don't know what else to call it. So you want to ask people real concretely, what are you going to do about pollution and contamination? What are you going to do about new housing for this area? What are you going to do about getting our public schools back?
It'll be interesting questions to pose, and can be posed to some of the candidates that are going to be at the Temple Israel debate on Sunday.
There's got to be a mayoral debate. I haven't found it.
Well, I know that the League of Women Voters in Northwest Indiana is working very hard to try to set up a similar candidates forum, if you want to even call it that, or a debate. And that's in the process of being worked out now. And so we hope to be able to have some word on that when things are finalized on that. So there'll be at least one and certainly more opportunities between now and May 7th to talk about the issues and find out what the candidates have to say.
You're going to want to pin them down. That's the main advice I give. Pin them down on something concrete, because on the generalized issues, they all sound good.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ruth, it sounds like you've certainly done your homework, as you always try to do when you come on to talk with us here on Regionally Speaking, but in particular about some ideas on questions that I'm sure that have been brought up and will be brought up if we have candidates closer to Election Day, primary Election Day, I should say, that will be questioned by the print media. They come in, sit and talk to the boards and to the editors, and when they will probably be likely to have an opportunity to pose some of these questions, and they'll bring up some other questions too. It'd be interesting to see what they say.
Well, they also give different answers to different constituencies, which is why these town hall meetings are so important.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that that we're going to find it, and maybe we're looking more at the city of Gary because there are more candidates, both city council and mayoral, on the ballot in the primary election than what you might expect maybe in East Chicago? There are a lot of candidates there too, but other
mayor
in other
there
cities,
too. Yeah. Hammond, there's no challenge, but East Chicago and Gary have challenges in the mayoral race, and. The city council has a number of contested positions.
So quite a few to watch on the primary ballot, to be sure, coming up here on May 7th.
So before you vote.
That's right. Ruth Needlin, thank you, as always, for being with us to talk about these issues and bring them up here, especially during this primary election days.
Okay, next
coming
time
up.
We'll do protests.
All right, sounds good. We'll hope to have you back for that.
Thank you.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Indiana Connected by 25 is a nonprofit that's based in Indianapolis that provides a financial, educational, as well as a social support for young people in the Hoosier State who either have or they're about to basically kind of get out of the state's foster care system because they've reached that age. And the organization is a number of them around the country. They are being very concerned about young people, their education, and particularly if they're in foster care after their 14th birthdays, and to make sure that they are not behind the eight ball, so to speak, that they have the same advantages and relationships that other young people of that age would have if they have family members. There is a new report that has just come out, in fact, the very first report for Indiana data concerning foster youth and education, and Indiana Connected by 25 is very concerned about the findings and how to deal with them. With us to talk about it today, we have Brent Kent. He's the CEO of Indiana Connected by 25, and Mr. Kent, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Tell us a little bit more about this inaugural report that has come out. It's basically come about because of action by the General Assembly.
That's right. It's legislation that actually Indiana Connected by 25 led last session. As you stated earlier, we work with foster youth as they're aging out of care or as if they've already aged out of care, and our goal is to help them transition to adulthood on their own successfully. And we want to make sure that by age 25 that they're thriving, they're housed, they're employed, and they're successful adults. But one of the biggest barriers to their success is the lack of a quality K-12 education. And it's a lot of factors that go into this, trauma, changing schools. On average, they'll change high schools three or four times. Their transcripts often don't follow them, so they're taking the same classes over again or out of sequence. But by and large, we have thousands of children in the state's own custody. And before this report, the state had no idea how they were doing in school, even though the state was making many education decisions on their behalf.
From the report that's come out here, you've had a chance to look over the data since it's been out for a few weeks. What have you found and some of the alarming facts that are in the report?
Mm-hmm. Well, we knew the data wouldn't be good, but we weren't prepared for how bad it is. Some of the key highlights is that only 64% of these young people are graduating high school. And about 21% of those graduate with a waiver that's waiving the graduation requirements to let them graduate. Mm-hmm. And what we know from national studies and a study of foster children in the Midwest, that one in five of these young people will be homeless within 2 years of leaving the state's care. 50% are unemployed at age 24, and only 3% ever obtain a college degree. And when you're looking at this data, it's no wonder. We see that foster children in our K-12 schools are disproportionately suspended and expelled, and there are massive achievement gaps on state assessments. Nowhere is this disparity greater than for Black students in foster care. We already know that foster care has a disproportionate negative effect on Black children and Black families. For example, Black children make up about 10% of the overall child population in Indiana, but about a quarter of the state's child welfare system. And what we see in this report is that our Black children are expelled at nearly four times the rate of their peers. And on statewide assessments, they're passing the 10th grade math I-STEP, for example, at a rate of 3.2%. So this report shows us two things. One, children are in foster care are being denied the same educational opportunities as their peers because of their experience in foster care. And two, the state is not doing enough to support their educational and lifetime success.
Are you finding from the data that you got from the report that mentioned about the achievement that these young people are not necessarily getting because of their situation being in foster care? How do they seem to stand on the ISTEP exams overall?
Mm-hmm. I don't have that data right in front of me, Chris. It is in the report, and it shows just a massive disparity between students in foster care and their peers.
Mm-hmm. I know that you have a number of supporters, of course, not only for Indiana Connected by 25 in the General Assembly, but I guess you have a number of supporters that, as a result, have helped you, I guess, in the effort to get the bill passed last year, last session, to be sure, and probably in turn they're looking at this data and they're showing their concerns as well.
That's right. Chris, we are a very small nonprofit organization. We work all over the state to do the best we can with the little resources we have. We're not an organization with a big budget for advocacy or legislative efforts, so we relied on partnerships with other nonprofits. We relied on former foster youth advocates and our donors to last year come with us to the State House and push this legislation. It was a bit of a David and Goliath story, but this was a necessary first step, getting this data. Without the data, we can't make decisions or a strategic plan around how to improve these outcomes.
Mm-hmm. I also know, too, that your organization is very interested in making sure that there's a tax credit program that will give nonprofits an opportunity to be able to show their support that maybe that hadn't been out there before. Is this right?
That's right. A lot of people don't realize Indiana is ground zero in a national child welfare crisis. Mm-hmm. We've had the highest increase in the number of children entering foster care. We have more children in the state's custody than any surrounding state, even states with two times our population. So what we're asking for is in the state budget, the legislature create a tax credit program. This would benefit nonprofits providing family preservation services and support to foster children so they can quickly respond to this crisis and scale up solutions and hopefully finally put an end to what is now a humanitarian disaster.
Do you know if there's any support right now in this current legislative session, or are you going to have to aim for the 2020 General Assembly session to get this plan together to get the tax credit program up before a vote?
Well, we are optimistic that it can happen this legislative session, mm-hmm. but I think the legislature needs to hear from more of the public. Like I said, we are doing our best, but we are not a legislative lobbying organization. We're a nonprofit providing services directly to youth in the field around the state. But they need to hear from more of the public. But we are optimistic we can make this happen this year.
Well, it sounds like, number one, even with the results being rather alarming from this inaugural report on foster youth educational outcomes, there's still some hope that something can be done. And with some help, with the measure that the lawmakers can pass to help set up this tax credit program, that other organizations can get together and then find other ways all together to help support Indiana's foster children. Thanks for telling us more about this and, unfortunately, some of the sad news about that new report. But we hope to have you back again to talk in better terms some other time.
Thank you for your time, Chris.
We've been talking with Brent Kent. He is the CEO of an organization here in Indiana, a nonprofit, Indiana Connected by 25. This is National Financial Literacy Month, and that means that we probably should get some advice from somebody who knows financial literacy pretty well. We're talking about Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. And Greg, as always, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, this being Financial Literacy Month, if you happen to know, why did this particular month, although I have my suspicions why, this month of April happened to be picked for Financial Literacy Month?
Well, I think your indications are good. It's always a good time to start thinking about the finances, especially when you're looking at analyzing what your income was for the last year and how your taxes ended up, and it just creates a great opportunity to take a closer look at things and maybe prioritize things a little bit different, refocus on some planning, and look at some of the things we could be doing moving forward.
We know it's very important, if you're not aware of dealing with financial matters, is to get some help, especially through even what maybe to some is the most simplest of things, that is setting up a budget. What are some of the points that we really should know about if we don't already know, and maybe just need some advice on in setting up a wise budget to work with?
Well, I think the key with the budget, I always tell people it's a good exercise, number one, just to kind of understand where the outflow is, where the money's going. Take a closer look at some of the things that you probably don't even realize you're spending money on. maybe evaluate, cut some unnecessary costs. But I think also, with the budget, people don't realize it's not just about expenses. You got to budget, some of your fun and your entertainment, and you got to add lifestyle to that type of budget. And it's different for everybody. In the beginning, obviously, one of the things you want to budget is, prioritizing your savings. I always tell people, pay yourself first. Start with whatever you can budget, and continue to grow on that, because it becomes easier over time. To try to jump to one large amount is not always the easiest thing to do, but if you begin with smaller amounts and keep adding on to them, especially through something like your 401ks, and if they have matching dollars, the contribution limits are up, and when you start putting that money away early, there's you reap the benefits of time when it comes to those investments.
Now, I know that you probably have them outlined here, you feel and have noted over the years of your experience. That might be five of some of the most common and maybe costly, very bad financial habits that people have. What are those, and how do you try and deal with those?
Well, I think just from a standpoint of habits, the easy thing when it comes to the bad stuff is not, again, starting with prioritizing your saving, right?
Right.
Most people think, hey, I'll get through, I'll do my major purchases first. I'll buy a home, and then you start a family, and you have kids, and then there's college, and all of a sudden retirement's creeping up on you. So having that as part of your overall planning process from the get-go is significant and important. And I think just being able to evaluate your risk exposure in that process, understanding time horizons are a great indicator as to some of the exposure you should have. But over time, by dollar cost averaging into those types of qualified plans, you can reap the benefits of that. And then I think, just overspending to a degree, where we're purchasing things. We all get caught up in the glamour and the lifestyle of having nicer things. And, as you begin to spend those things, that's less that you get to utilize towards spending down some debt and or, saving for things like retirement and, if you have children, significantly college, and, not looking at a plan, an income plan that helps understand cause and effect of everything. I think the biggest challenge most people face is, they tend to look at things in silos. I have my investment guy, I have my tax guy, I have my insurance guy, I have my legal guy, and without looking at those as more of a holistic type of planning process, it often becomes difficult to have the effectiveness as if you were to create an income plan and look at how those things intertwine and how they, one area affects the other.
I guess, yeah, that is one thing that you don't think about. If you separate all those into different categories, and just keeping even people separate out of the equation, if you blend them all together, or at least you tie them all together, it gives you a better picture, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And I tell people, a lot of times they still have their particular specialist that they like, maybe their relationships with current advisors or attorneys or tax people, and you can still have that. But I think the important part, Chris, is to have somebody that kind of quarterbacks it, looks at from a high level what you're doing in all areas and talks about the gaps that exist. Because a simple example that I always use is often people's advisors never talk to who does their taxes. And so what you end up with is in taxes more of a preparation instead of planning, and an investment's more about just making money. And without considering those two together, you could often structure programs that will cause a lot more tax implications than you even realize, and understanding how to control them in the distribution phase is significant. When we're younger and we're working, there's not much we're going to do in terms of controlling taxes, because you're never going to say, hey, pay me less money.
Mm-hmm.
But as you begin those distributions, how you set up those accounts for your future will directly determine things like provisional income, which will determine whether or not you pay taxes on your Social Security, or how do you hedge against tax implications for a single tax bracket in case of a surviving spouse. Do we have our beneficiaries designated properly? Even consolidating your assets, and having them, in some type of structure where how everything's working together instead of independently.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some things to make note of during this Financial Literacy Month. What are some more of some of the more common and rather costly bad financial habits that sometimes we tend to get ourselves into?
Well, I think some of the biggest things as people move, the pre-retirees and retirees, as they begin to move and what we term the distribution phase, you know, often they're going to, when you get in there, things happen differently in the way of taxes, how they work and how they function, and whether or not we should look at things like a Roth IRA versus a traditional IRA. You know, most people that are savers do a very good job at saving, but they don't understand, you know, where should I have it land, and more significantly, when they're going to utilize those assets, when and how to take them out. And that's what a good income plan will help you understand, and it'll help you understand things like volatility in the market. How does it affect things, you know, when I'm in the distribution phase, and understanding things like sequence of return risk, which is probably the largest danger that you have with your assets as you move into retirement, that volatility of the marketplace, you know, when and how do I set up my assets to help guard against that particular gap, and how do I address some of the concerns and priorities I have, and look at it again from that holistic state.
Do we find that sometimes people, maybe they may, as you say, they may be good savers, but they don't always know when the time is to not necessarily stop saving, but they should maybe back off on their saving a bit and start looking at how they're going to be able to use what they have saved?
Well, that, and as well as, you know, where they're saving, because a lot of people will be really good savers, but at times it could be counterproductive to have too much money going into just pre-tax dollars as opposed to looking at some after-tax vehicles and or Roth IRAs, because then the planning aspect of the distribution becomes a little more difficult. If I have one source and that's the only source I can go to, you know, it's harder to be flexible in terms of creating the income to minimize or mitigate the tax implications. And, you know, when and how do we pay down debt versus, you know, saving and analyzing. You know, a lot of times, a simple example, I see a lot of people saving money significantly, but yet they're carrying a balance on credit cards from month to month that is just completely counterproductive to what they're trying to do on the saving side.
Well, finally here, let's take a look here, since we kind of mentioned at the outset of our conversation about this being a Financial Literacy Month and kind of alluded to the fact that, of course, it's the time that most people are most concerned about their money when it's time to work on the income tax returns and figure out whether, and particularly now with the changes in the tax law, as to whether we've had enough taken out or have more taken out or maybe less taken out, I guess. Are there these the concerns that maybe we're running into in these last days before April 15th?
Yeah, and I think a lot of the mystery around the tax returns this year is simply because of the tax law changes. We emphasize a lot with our clients, say, you know, last year to be proactive, because when these law changes came into effect, in general, I would say most people are actually paying less in taxes, but there were changes in their withholdings because the sheer nature of how withholdings are done through the payroll system is based on the current, you know, tax code. So when those tax codes were implemented, often withholdings were changed, and people that might have been covering liabilities from one source, i.e. their payroll, to cover things like maybe a distribution from 1099 income or from interest income, those withholdings were adjusted according to the new tax code, and without taking a look at them, while paying less in taxes, people often found themselves with significantly less refunds or potentially even owing, and, you know, we're left wondering why.
So I guess in short, it's maybe a very busy time for you folks here as you're working with your clients and trying to help get their tax returns and other vital information all together to turn over to Uncle Sam or the State House, whichever the case may be, or both. I mean, I guess it's time to, I guess, look back and make sure that you're all lined up so at least you go into next year a little bit better shape.
Yeah, we actually encourage everybody to come in after tax season, when things are less hectic. During tax season, we tell people it's about preparation.
Yeah.
We can't change the input from 2018 to affect that return today. What's happened has happened. But within the year of 2019, if you take the time, dedicate some time to sit down, look at, understand a little bit more about what's actually going on with your payroll, with your investments, and what the input's going to be and project forward, it's a lot easier to make those adjustments and those tweaks, you know, during the 2019 year, when in effect it will create the results that you want on the tax return, as opposed to just, again, bringing in the data, here's the input, can't change it now, but let me know how I did.
Well, Greg, as always, thanks for spending time with us to talk about these important matters, and particularly with this Financial Literacy Month. And looking into May, there probably will be more concerns we'll bring up to you as well, too. Thanks for being with us today, though.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. A lack of childcare has become an issue in many Indiana cities, not just because parents have to take days off to watch their kids, but also because of the loss of worker productivity hurts municipalities that are hoping to grow. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton has more from Crawfordsville.
Inside Wabash College English professor Agata Stashek Brewer's office, markers and crayons are scattered on the floor, along with paper covered in a child's artwork.
Just today, when I was waiting for you to arrive to record the interview, I had both kids with me at the office.
Her 20-month-old daughter was sick and unable to go to childcare for today. But for her 9-year-old son, it's spring break, and Stashek Brewer was unable to find a place that would watch him for the week.
So he spent the entire week with me at the office, going with me from meeting to meeting, going to the classroom when I was teaching. And so that certainly wasn't optimal for him or for me.
Stashek Brewer had to cancel student meetings and dedicate work time to watching her children. A recent report from the Indiana Business Review says it's a common problem. The study examines the ratio of children to childcare providers throughout Indiana and finds Montgomery County is one of many struggling to meet demand. Crawfordsville faces a tough challenge, with national unemployment at 3.8%, and Indiana's even lower. It's competing with other communities to attract workers. But for workers who choose the city, it has to have amenities they need, such as available daycare. Perry County officials and businesses collaborated by bringing groups together to form a community child care center. With a population of about 16,000, Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton says large corporations only locate smaller branches in Crawfordsville, meaning it's less likely those operations will offer their own child care to employees. So he's assembled what he calls a child care initiatives team to look at possible ways to address the shortage. He's trying to bring businesses together, but has looked at other solutions, including encouraging unlicensed child care providers to consider licensure.
Many of them are not licensed. Maybe they're apprehensive about that process. We want to, you know, just make sure that they understand it's not a scary process and that we are here to help guide them and bring them along if they so choose.
Okay, who's ready for crackers?
Cookies! There you go, sis.
Trinity Carr serves peanut butter and crackers with milk to the children at her in-home business, Precious Lambs Daycare.
Are you done with your bottle?
Before becoming a licensed provider, Carr watched just a handful of children at a time, which is legal in Indiana, so long as no more than 5 unrelated kids are being cared for at once. Eventually, she decided to grow, which meant seeking a license, a move she believes made people more comfortable coming to her.
I felt that with being licensed, parents would be more lenient towards a licensed in-home because they know that with license comes with rules and regulations that I would have to follow.
Having a license has also given her the ability to get food reimbursement and take vouchers from parents. But like many daycares, a lot of her business has come through word of mouth, and that's led to a common problem, creation of a waiting list that can go months between available spots. Carr says Crawfordsville must have childcare, so she supports others opening up their homes as either licensed or unlicensed providers. But state officials say getting a license can take 6 months to a year from the time of application. Agata Stashek Brewer is still on the wait list for a licensed center to get her daughter into, but has been able to find a temporary spot at an unlicensed facility. And while she likes the teachers, she has concerns.
There are some structural problems and overcrowding. But that is our only option, so beggars can't be choosers.
She says she loves her job and has no plans to leave Crawfordsville. But if she does, she says childcare availability will be her number one priority. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Samantha Horton.
This is Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The Calumet region is made up of diverse communities, innovative industries, ecosystems that are very resilient, especially over the passage of time. And so now we're trying to piece all these things together to create an interesting situation that is called the Calumet Heritage Area. And for that, let's turn to the executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, Sarah Colder. Sarah, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
I'm glad to be here, Chris. Thank you for inviting me.
I'll take a few minutes, if you will, explain to listeners that may or may not be aware of it. Maybe they've been residents or they've been visitors, where the Calumet heritage really starts in, the region that it encompasses, and why it's now becoming so important. They really have to expand it further with this Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative.
The Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative has been almost a two-decades-long process in building support, getting people engaged, and it was really spearheaded by a nonprofit bi-state organization called the Calumet Heritage Partnership. They, along with their partners at the Field Museum, worked on creating a feasibility study, which is kind of the first step in actually becoming a designated heritage area. The feasibility study is required by the National Park Service to ensure that your idea for a nationally significant heritage area meets all their criteria. The Heritage Area Program actually started with the I&M Canal Heritage Area back in 1984, and that is along the I&M Canal in the state of Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
The Calumet Heritage Partnership, along with the partners at the Field Museum, shepherded a feasibility study through the process at the National Park Service. When it came to determining how a all-volunteer nonprofit organization was going to coordinate an extensive and highly sophisticated heritage area as a National Park Service program, they really didn't have a whole lot of staff capacity or time available because they're an all-volunteer organization.
I see.
The Calumet Collaborative, which is who I work for, is also a bi-state nonprofit organization that works to pull together partners across state lines to work on nationally and regionally, most specifically regionally specific and significant projects. So being that the Heritage Partnership has spearheaded and shepherded it as far as they have, we have become partners with them to take it to that next level. So all of the partners and stakeholders that are part of the advisory council of the Calumet Collaborative have joined in with those partners at the Calumet Heritage Partnership to forward the Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative.
We talk about this Calumet Heritage Area. It's very big. We kind of alluded to it at the beginning of our conversation about geographically, at least. But it involves, I guess, among other things, two national parks. We know what the newest one of the two is, which, of course, is the new Indiana Dunes National Park. What's the second, the more established national park, so to speak, that's out there that's all part of this?
Yes. So we like to say that we are bookended by two National Park Service properties. The Pullman National Monument on the Illinois side and to the northwest, and the newly created or newly renamed Indiana Dunes National Park to the east. The Calumet Heritage Area is really kind of made up of both the Calumet watershed as well as the Calumet region workshed, story shed. So while it encompasses a very large portion of geography, it actually is meant to, because there's so many stories and significant events that have happened in this really vast region that can be attributed to the significance and the history and the knowledge and the innovation and the activism that all occurred in the Calumet region.
I understand, too, that a large part of what is encompassed in the area not only includes the national parks, in this case, the two bookends, as you referred to, but also about local parks and trails and how tourism fits in, too. Tell us how that would fit into it as the project goes through.
Calumet Heritage Area isn't a specific place on a map. It's an entire landscape of a lived-in landscape. That's how we like to describe it. So all of the parks, all of the trails, all of the small businesses within this geography make a difference to the operation of this heritage area. Partner support is crucial in order to make it successful. So with each park, with each trail, with each small business, coffee shop, or restaurant, all working together, we can shine a light on this region that we believe, I believe, mm-hmm. is incredibly interesting, incredibly unique, and has so many stories to tell that we can not only learn from, but celebrate in the region.
Then you talk, too, about economic development. In particular, you talk about small businesses, coffee shops, whatever they may be. They're all very much a part of this mosaic that makes up the National Heritage Area. What kind of advantages would local businesses be able to get if this National Heritage Area comes to fruition?
Well, a lot of people think of tourism, right? As you have a place to visit, a place to go, and once you go there, you need to have drinks or coffees or beers or whatever for those people traveling there. But we're not necessarily thinking of just the outsiders coming into the region, but the intra-region use of all of the assets in the heritage area. So if you're traveling from Flossmoor to Gary, you'll be hopefully supporting small businesses in Gary. And likewise, if you're traveling from Crown Point to Pullman, you'll have the ability to support small businesses in the Pullman neighborhood. So that's where some of the economic development, or at least one portion of the economic development that we see as a result of the establishment of the heritage area. The second part of economic development we see as part of the heritage area initiative is by shining in the light and by increasing the pride of place for residents, and to have this kind of beginning economic development, it will show how many fantastic communities are located in the Calumet region and why people would want to live, work, or play there, and hopefully lift up these communities as livable communities and increase the tax base by having new residents, by retaining more residents, as well as hopefully by that time having large employers or small employers locate in the region because they want to be part of these strong, cohesive communities.
We're talking with Sarah Coulter. She's the executive director of the Calumet Collaborative, which is a bi-state organization that includes Indiana as well as Illinois. And one of the things in particular that I understand, Sarah, that's really underway now is the timetable for creating this National Heritage Area for the Calumet region. And I guess it's actually started in, I guess, late last year in 2018, but it's continuing on through much of this year, is it not?
Yes. We have established a coordinating committee with our partners in CHP, so Calumet Collaborative and CHP working together. And we've laid out five different areas that we need to work on together to forward the advancement of this initiative. The first one is programs. How do we establish good programs that will encourage people to come out and visit different sites in the region? Within our programming arm, we are working with the Field Museum and a number of local historical societies, galleries, and museums in the Calumet region to put together a traveling exhibit that will start this year in June 27th in the Pullman Visitor Center. And it's a collaboration between a number of different historical societies, galleries, and other historians putting together an exhibit that will highlight some of the stories of the region. That exhibit will then travel to Gary in December of 2019. After Gary, and it will be at the Gary Public Library. Mm-hmm. After the Gary Public Library, it will move to the Brouwer Museum at Valparaiso University, and then in 2020. And then in 2021, there will be a full 11-month exhibit at the Field Museum. So that's just the programming arm of what we've got going on this year.
Well, that's a lot. That's an awful lot when you think about it. And a very, very coordinated effort, too, because you have not only what's being done there with CHP, but also, too, it's got to get coordinated with all of the other partners that are involved in Gary, in Valparaiso, and in all the other communities that will be along the way.
Absolutely. Another initiative that we're working on is the advocacy portion. Yeah. And this is kind of the key part that is working to actually get the designation through Congress, and it's a little bit tricky, and there's a lot of politics and government speak in this process. But after we have received a letter from the National Park Service saying we've met all their criteria, the next step, and so that's pretty much the green light from the National Park Service. What that means then is that now it's up to Congress to actually designate the Calumet Heritage Area as a national heritage area. That's a little bit trickier. Congress is a little bit tough to work with sometimes, but what we've done is we've created some draft legislation. We've met with our congressional delegation of Congressman Dislofsky and Congresswoman Kelly's office to talk about the draft legislation that we have come up with. And the next step would be to introduce it as a bill. From there, to get that bill passed. And then from there, to have funds allocated to the Calumet Heritage Area.
Well, it sounds like a lot of work, as you say, yet to be done here going into 2019 here. We just started in the year, just a few months in, a lot more that's going to continue on besides all of the great programs where residents and can keep track and learn more in particular about the Calumet heritage, what they see, what they don't see, what's there in the history books, as well as what they get to see in their own eyes, the nature as well. If there is any place that people want to go to find out more information, tell us more about the website that's been established to talk more about it.
Sure. Our website has been established for the Calumet Heritage Area, and the web address is just simply www.calumetheritagearea.org. From that website, you can find out more about our programs. You can find more about the process of becoming a heritage area. You can find out more about who's involved in the project. But more importantly, you will be able to sign up for a newsletter that will give you monthly updates on how we're doing on the other aspects of our work, the management planning, our communications rollout with our identity and branding project for the heritage area, as well as some projects that we hope to fundraise for and reach out to get additional partners involved in the work of establishing a heritage area.
Well, I know that's going to be the very, very important part of all this, too. There's a lot of work that others can help out in, and the partnerships that can be established out there to help us not only stretch the word out, but also stretch the dollars, too, that you have to spend to be able to educate and promote as well, too. And again, that website address is calumetheritagearea.org. And Sarah, thank you very much for spending time to go over this in great detail. With 2019 underway, a lot more work to go done to the year. We hope to be able to check back with you later on, and especially when we get closer to the exhibits that are going out on the Calumet Voices National Stories projects that are going to be going around the region.
Great. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. We've been talking with Sarah Colter. She's the Executive Director of Calumet Collaborative about the Calumet National Heritage Area Initiative. And that's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Tomorrow, Thursday, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday. And joining us, we'll have Lake County Government Reporter Will Rackey from The Times and his colleague, Education Reporter Carly Lanich. We hope you can join us.